From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the war in the former Yugoslavia, from the perspective of a journalist who has been covering it since it started. Misha Glenny is the BBC's correspondent in Central Europe. He'll tell us why this savage war has also been particularly dangerous for journalists. And he'll explain what the fighting is about and why it might spread. And Glenny says the election victory of Slobodan Milosevic is a sign the war is likely to spread. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new box set of Billie Holiday recordings from 1945 to 1959, the year she died. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House has announced that President Bush will spend New Year's Day with U.S. troops in Somalia. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
In a brief statement released this afternoon, Mr. Bush's press secretary said the visit is meant to demonstrate, quote, United States concern for the people of Somalia, our commitment to humanitarian assistance, and our support for Americans and United Nations forces, end quote. The president will arrive in Somalia on December 31st in time to spend New Year's Eve with the troops and will spend January 1st visiting relief operations. Mr. Bush ordered about 28,000 U.S. troops into the drought-stricken African nation earlier this month, and he had been urged by the head of the relief agency, CARE, to witness the situation for himself. The visit will be reminiscent of the Thanksgiving trip the president made to Saudi Arabia as U.S. forces were preparing for the Gulf War in 1990. But this trip will come less than a month before Mr. Bush turns over his job and responsibility for the troops to Bill Clinton. I'm Andy Bowers at the White House.
The Israeli Supreme Court has upheld the government's expulsion of 415 Palestinians and rejected appeals that the men be returned from a no-man's land in Lebanon. The Israeli army maintains that the Palestinians are safe and that they're the responsibility of Lebanon because they're on Lebanese soil. The government is still under a 30-day Supreme Court order to prove that it acted legally in expelling the Palestinians without going through normal appeals procedures. Israel claims the men are activists in the Muslim fundamentalist groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad. At least one key member of Russia's reformist government has resigned today, but several other members of the economic team of former Prime Minister Yegor Gaidar appear to be holding on to their posts. The new conservative prime minister is expected to name the key ministers of foreign affairs and security tomorrow. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
The one-lined resignation of Russia's key foreign debt negotiator, Pyotr Avin, could deal a blow to the crucial process of rescheduling Russia's $80 billion debt with international lending institutions such as the IMF and World Bank. So far, the young former diplomat is the only one of the so-called Gaidar team who's definitely out of the running for the new government. But several key reformers, including two vice premiers, Anatoly Chubais and Alexander Shokin, and the economics minister, Andrei Nechayev, will be included in the new cabinet. Meanwhile, the Conservative Parliament today gave itself the power to approve four crucial cabinet posts: defense, internal affairs, security, and foreign affairs. The latter posting is widely expected to see the departure of another Yeltsin ally, Andrei Kozarev, who's been accused by the Conservative opposition for being too conciliatory to the West. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 9 points to close at 3,321. This is NPR News. President-elect Clinton named the top officials of his national security and foreign policy team today, including many who served in the Carter administration. Warren Christopher, who was the number two man in the Carter State Department, was chosen to be Secretary of State. House Armed Services Chairman Les Aspin was named to be the Secretary of Defense. Clinton nominated former Carter aide Madeleine Albright to be the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. A coalition of gay and lesbian groups is calling for national support for an economic embargo against the state of Colorado because of an amendment that voids laws that protect homosexuals from discrimination. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
The group say that in the time leading up to and following the passage of Amendment 2, they've seen a sharp uptick in verbal and physical abuse toward gays and lesbians in Colorado. Tim McFeely, the executive director of the Human Rights Campaign Fund, says the coalition is calling for businesses to cancel conventions in the state and for travelers to postpone vacation plans there.
At a time when the extremist right is plotting anti-gay assaults on perhaps a dozen state ballots, we must do everything possible to alert the country to the cost that will be paid when intolerance and bigotry win.
Members of the coalition say President-elect Clinton could signal his desire to see the Colorado law overturned by helping them pass a federal civil rights law protecting gays and lesbians. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
The Energy Department announced today that it will move weapons production work from plants in Ohio, Florida, and Colorado and consolidate it at a facility near Kansas City, Missouri. Energy Secretary James Watkins said the move will save as much as $2 billion over the life of the plants. It's expected to cost as many as 1,000 jobs in Ohio, 500 in Florida, and 700 at the Rocky Flats weapons plant near Denver. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in the former Yugoslavia threatens to spread. The United States and other Western nations are considering taking action to enforce the ban on military flights over Bosnia. We are horrified at the brutality of this war, but most of us are also very confused about what the fighting is about. We asked Misha Glennie to help explain. Glennie has been covering the war for the BBC. He's their correspondent in Central Europe. His reports are often carried on National Public Radio. Glennie has written about the war and the history leading up to it in his new book, The Fall of Yugoslavia. Glennie is spending the next few weeks in London. We were able to speak with him earlier today from the NPR bureau there. Slobodan Milosevic has claimed victory in Sunday's election in Serbia. His opponent, Prime Minister Milan Panic, who supports an end to the war, called the vote invalid because of fraud, theft, and cheating. I asked Glennie if he thinks the vote shows genuine popular support for Milosevic.
Although it's not an absolutely accurate reflection of support for Milosevic in Serbia, I think it's a pretty good one. I think that Milosevic over the past 3 or 4 months has done a very good job of coming back from what was almost a political grave at the end of the summer. And he has rallied Serbian opinion around him. He's an extremely cunning and clever tactician politically, Milosevic. And I think a lot of Serbs do support him. What's really striking and almost distressing about the election is the dramatic growth in support for his ally, the leader of the Serbian Radical Party, Vojislav Šešelj, who is little more than a fascist.
Do you think the war is more likely to spread because of Milosevic's re-election?
I certainly do, because he is now likely to activate his policy of creating a greater Serbian state. We've already seen in the last couple of months moves by the Serbs in Croatia in the United Nations protected areas to unite their self-proclaimed state with the self-proclaimed state of the Bosnian Serbs. And that is the first step towards the creation of a greater Serbia. This receives the support of Milosevic. And the real danger of this is that if Milosevic does go ahead and try and consolidate a greater Serbian state, it will necessarily result in similar movements among the other national groups in the Balkans, particularly amongst the Albanians, who will see this as a signal to start thinking about uniting their three territories, which are in three countries. And also the Croatians will not tolerate the attempt by the Serbs to join the Serb-occupied areas of Croatia with Bosnia. And unless we have a diplomatic miracle within the next 6 months or so, I think we're going to see pressure building in Croatia to restore Croatian sovereignty over the Serb-occupied areas of Croatia by force. That is, we will see a revival of the Serb-Croat war, which at the moment is only in a frozen state.
If the war spreads, how likely do you think that it is to spread beyond the Balkans into something more closely resembling a world war?
Well, first of all, we have to take it step by step. I mean, if the war does spread in the Balkans, it will initially spread south And the main focus, the main theatre of war, will be the Republic of Macedonia, which has not yet been recognised by the international community because of objections by Greece, which claims that the name Macedonia is exclusively Hellenic property. This has put Macedonia in a very, very delicate situation. It has a large Albanian minority, and there is a danger of a social implosion inside Macedonia, which would then provoke a war between any of the four surrounding states, that's Albania, Greece, Serbia and Bulgaria, with possibly Turkey intervening as well. So that would be the start. That would be the Third Balkan War, as we refer to it. And from that, you get a whole series of conflicts between European states, the most disturbing of which is a possible conflict between Russia and Turkey, which could then develop quite easily into some form of European war. Now, if Europe is at war, then the rest of the world tends to suffer. Whether that would spread out to become a world war, I very much doubt, but I certainly think that there is a real possibility within the next 10 years or so of a major destabilization of the European continent and several different types of armed conflict going on around Eastern and Southeastern Europe in particular.
What do you think the United States, the United Nations, Europe should be doing now?
Western policy towards the disintegration of Yugoslavia has, in many respects, contributed to the spread of the violence there. The most important decision that did so was the German decision to recognize Croatia unconditionally, without the agreement of part of the European community initially, and certainly with the opposition of the United States. Now, once Croatia was recognized, that posed the question of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Bosnia-Herzegovina was not in a position to constitute itself as an independent state, and yet at the same time, once Croatia had been given the green light to leave Yugoslavia, it meant that a majority of people in Bosnia, basically the Muslims and the Croats, were not prepared to stay in Yugoslavia. So the West forced Bosnia's hand, as it were, and the majority decided to leave, despite the fact that they had not secured agreements with the Serbs, and the Serbs said that they were going to wage war if Bosnia attempted to leave, and that's what they did, and the Serbs were perfectly straightforward about that. So the West, to an extent, has got itself in this mess. Now, what we are doing now is reacting emotively to the level of atrocities committed by the Serbs in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We are not responding to the political problematic which underlies the Bosnian question. As a consequence, we're now getting a lot of saber-rattling, particularly from the outgoing administration in the United States at the moment. And the effect of this is to homogenize Serb opinion behind Milosevic and towards more nationalist solutions. If we go in militarily to Bosnia-Herzegovina, if we enforce a no-fly zone and shoot down Serbian planes, and we do it without a clear political goal behind that policy, merely as a response of moral indignation to what the Serbs get up to in Bosnia-Herzegovina, then we run a very grave risk that the Serbs will create trouble elsewhere. They feel aggrieved because they do not believe, and they have some right on their side in this issue, that they are not the only people who caused this war. It was much more complex a war than merely a question of Serbian aggression. So that the Serbs will say, right, if the world is against us and they haven't listened to our case, we will show them what a Balkan war is really about. And I fear that, particularly after Milosevic's election now, that if there is military intervention which does not address the political issue underlying the conflict in Bosnia-Herzegovina, then the Serbs will be tempted even to go into Kosovo, their southern province, where there's a majority of Albanian population, and provoke a war and simply exterminate large numbers of Albanians. They're perfectly capable of doing that. All the Balkan peoples, once the Balkan War wars begin to unravel, are capable of the most appalling atrocities. And that's something we have to bear in mind when we respond to the crisis.
What are the political issues that you think Europe and the United States would need to address?
Well, there are a whole series of political issues now which the Yugoslav crisis have thrown up, which have a very important impact not just on the Balkans, but above all else on the former Soviet Union. The first question is the question of minority populations throughout Eastern Europe, because it is these, the minority populations, which spark off the trouble. The other thing is the question of borders and territorial gain. Now, what we should have done the minute that communism collapsed in 1989 was to make it very clear to everybody in Eastern Europe that A, borders shall not change, and B, minority populations will be given international guarantees for their safety, for their autonomy, and for their democratic development. These issues were not addressed at all by the West, which was too busy in the Gulf at the time, and also too obsessed with what was going on in the former Soviet Union in terms of the coup and Gorbachev's survival and so on and so forth. And at that same time in Yugoslavia, these enormous issues were bursting out. The threat of war was imminent. To anyone who was in Yugoslavia, we knew that the war was coming. We were telling the world that the war was coming. And basically, people ignored us. And unless you address those central issues, for which the Yugoslav example is a perfect model, then what we've seen happening in Yugoslavia is going to happen elsewhere in Eastern Europe. In particular, it's going to happen in the former Soviet Union with this potential monster, Russia, at its centre, because all of this takes place to a background of chronic economic decline. And again, the West is not addressing that problem. And it's, although what happens in Somalia, what happens in Cambodia are terrible things, if the West doesn't address the problem of Eastern Europe, then you are looking at a massive destabilization of Europe. And as I've said before, when Europe destabilizes, then so does the rest of the world.
My guest is Misha Glenny, the BBC's Central Europe correspondent and author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Misha Glenny, who is the Central Europe correspondent for the BBC, and he's been covering the war in the former Yugoslavia. Tell us something about Milosevic's character. He's the former Communist Party chief in Yugoslavia. You describe him as a man without passion, without any real nationalist motivation, a man who has never shown any regard for the masses on which he relies for support.
That's right. He is the most extraordinary character, Milosevic. He is a very, very cunning politician. I don't believe that he's a real nationalist because I don't think he cares about people at all, and I don't think he cares about Serbs. He is prepared to sacrifice Serbs just as he is prepared to oversee the destruction of towns like Vukovar in Croatia. And that's what I mean when I said he's a man without passion, with no real nationalist feeling. The only thing which apparently motivates him is his lust for power. And to achieve that, he is apparently prepared to do anything. But he is a dazzling figure politically in a certain respect, because there is nobody who has yet proved to be a match for him. And that includes many, many very experienced international diplomats. I've met Milosevic on a few occasions, and he's extraordinarily confident of himself and what he is doing. There is nothing that fazes him. You can ask him any question. You can accuse him of being a war criminal, a mass murderer, or whatever, and he doesn't bat an eyelid. It really doesn't seem to upset him. However, once you walk out of the door, He'll make sure that he knows that he remembers that you're an enemy. Most other politicians in the Balkans, if you accuse them of being incompetent or war criminals or whatever, will go into an apoplectic rage, but not Milosevic. He is so calculating and so intelligent that he will not allow any emotion to get into the way of his central aim, and that is the maintenance of power at all costs.
You've warned against simplistic good guy versus bad guy views of this war. Are the Serbs just the bad guys in this, or do the Serbian people have legitimate concerns?
They do have legitimate concerns. Everybody in this war has legitimate concerns. If we demonize the Serbs, and if we say if you curb the Serbs, or if you get rid of Milosevic, or if you simply throttle the Serbian war machine, then peace will be restored to the Balkans, then you do not understand that what we are dealing with are massive structural problems arising out of the transformation of the entire East European area and the former Soviet Union from communism to capitalism, where all sorts of nasty historical monsters are crawling out of the closet, which, unless we deal with them, are going to create problems. Now, obviously, the Serbs have done the most appalling things in this war, and the level of violence for which they are responsible clearly outstrips everybody else in the region. However, the reason for that is because the Serbs are the largest population in the region, and they have the broadest spread of minorities. Like everybody else in the region, they have a fairly primitive social structure, and when things get bad, they tend to revert to their more violent traditions. But it's not only the Serbs to whom that happens. That happens to most people in this area.
So do Serbs have legitimate complaints about the way Serbian minorities are treated outside Serbia?
Well, certainly in Croatia, they had very, I think, legitimate fears about what would happen. A lot of this, of course, is self-fulfilling prophecies. Milosevic was talking about the Croats perpetrating genocide against the Serbs in Croatia before it actually happened. And then when the war started, of course, those Serbs who lived in areas under Croatian control found themselves in real trouble because the Croats took out their vengeance against the Serbs for what was happening in the Serb-controlled areas, against those loyal Serbs who had decided to stay in Croatia. And there were several very appalling massacres of Serbs by Croats during this war, and tens of thousands of Serbs have been driven out of Croatia. These are people who never lifted a weapon against the Croats at all and would never have had any intention of doing so, by the Croatian army, by the Croatian police force, while the war was going on. And that's still happening. That's still happening today in Zagreb, in Karlovac, in other Croatian cities. Serbian houses are being bombed, Serbs are being beaten up. Just 2.5 days ago, a leading Serb figure in Zagreb was murdered. And so they do have legitimate concerns, certainly. Everybody in this area who is in a minority, whether it's the Croats in Serbia or the Serbs in Croatia, the Albanians in Kosovo, the Muslims in Serbia, or whatever, all of them have real reasons for fearing for their safety. But that includes the Serbs.
Muslims have been getting massacred and pushed out of Bosnia. The Muslims in Bosnia-Herzegovina are of several nationalities, Slavs, Croats, Serbs. How much is their religious identity a part of why Milosevic wants them to be, quote, cleansed from Bosnia?
This is a very complicated question that you've asked there. In fact, you've asked about five questions, but I'll see what I can do. The Muslims in Bosnia-Herzegovina are the greatest victims of this war. This war is essentially a war between Serbs and Croats who want to define their borders. Unfortunately, the Muslims of Bosnia-Herzegovina are right in the middle of this. This is because they are Slavs, as are the Serbs and the Croats, who came to Bosnia who were converted to the Islamic faith by the Ottomans during five centuries of occupation. They were originally Serbs or Croats. However, over those five centuries, they have developed an identity of their own, which is very specific. The only way, unfortunately, although they were considered by Tito and Yugoslavia during communist Yugoslavia as a nation, the Muslim nation, the only way that they really are defined historically is through their religious faith. In fact, you find in Bosnia that people are called either Muslims, Orthodox, or Catholics. The Bosnians actually define themselves by religion and not as to whether they're Serbs, Croats, or Muslims. Of course, all the Orthodox people are Serbs, all the Catholics are Croats, and all the Muslims are Muslims.
What explains the level of hatred that must exist to explain the mass murder and the mass rape of Muslims?
This is a really curious and difficult question, and one that all of us who have worked in Yugoslavia try and answer. But the barbarity perpetrated by all sides in this conflict, but particularly by the Serbs against the Muslims in Bosnia-Herzegovina, does have very complicated historical roots. Essentially what the problem is that all these people who live in Bosnia-Herzegovina, although they define themselves as Croat Serbs or Muslims, as Catholics, Orthodox or Muslims, they are in fact all of the same ethnos. They all speak the same language. They all essentially come from the same place. They have been divided over the centuries by the most enormous historical splits in Europe between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church, between Islam and Christianity. And all these great empires all converged. Their borders were frequently running right through the middle of Bosnia-Herzegovina and Croatia. Now, that means that those Slavs who lived there were used as the foot soldiers of those empires. They are military people, largely, particularly the Serbs and the Croats. And so they are trained fighters. When they see each other on the other side of the barricade, they understand each other to be the heathen enemy, the great heretics. But because they also recognize their own Slav brothers on the other side of their barricade, they cannot cope with the fact that those people who they've been told are Christendom's enemies or Islam's enemies are in fact the same people in themselves. They decide to exterminate the people on the other side of the barricade. And that's why we get so many incidences in Bosnia-Herzegovina of facial mutilation in particular, flaying of skin, dismemberment, rape, the humiliation of women, particularly the rape of Muslim women by Serb soldiers and Serb civilian population. That is because they are steeped in centuries of a blood culture from which it's very difficult once a war begins for them to emerge from. And, you know, these appalling things that we see going on in Europe now, which we thought were over and finished with the collapse of the Nazi empire, just go to prove that although we're at the end of the 20th century, that humankind, and in particular Europeans, find it very, very difficult to escape from their extremely depressing and violent history.
Misha Glenny is the BBC's correspondent in Central Europe and author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia, published by Penguin Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Glenny will be back with us in the second part of our show to talk about his experiences covering the war.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Covering the war in the former Yugoslavia has been very dangerous for journalists. The BBC's Misha Glenny has had many close calls. Coming up in the second part of our discussion, Glenny tells us about the difficulties he's faced reporting on the war. Also, another Christmas gift suggestion from one of our critics. Kevin Whitehead tells us about a new boxed set of Billie Holiday recordings from 1945 to 1959. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today that President Bush will visit U.S. troops in Somalia over New Year's. Fitzwater said the visit will demonstrate U.S. concern for the people of Somalia, as well as support for the humanitarian assistance already underway in that African nation. Mr. Bush will leave for Somalia on December 30th. Meanwhile, the U.S.-led military operation in that country is continuing its expansion. According to military officials, U.S. Marines will move into the town of Bardera on Christmas Eve, while French troops should reach the town of Hodor by Christmas Day. Troops will reach other towns later in the month. President-elect Bill Clinton has named his national security and foreign policy teams. He has tapped Transition Director Warren Christopher to be Secretary of State and House Armed Services Committee Chairman Les Aspin to be Secretary of Defense. NPR's Mara Liasson has more from Little Rock.
Clinton said he wanted steady hands and bold new thinking, and in forming his foreign policy and national security team, he's tried to combine the two. The majority of appointments are former Carter administration officials. In addition to Christopher, Clinton chose Anthony Lake, the director of policy planning in Carter's State Department, as national security advisor. Lake's former deputy, Sandy Berger, now a lawyer and lobbyist in Washington, will join Lake again at the NSC. James Woolsey, who served in the Nixon, Carter, and Bush administrations, will head the CIA. Madeleine Albright, a former Carter NSC aide, was picked for United Nations ambassador, a post Clinton says he will elevate to cabinet rank. Of the team, Aspin and Lake are considered to be leaders in the effort to rethink American foreign policy and military structure to meet the demands of the post-Cold War world. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
NPR's Nina Totenberg reports that Clinton has also settled on Brooks Lee Bourne as his choice for attorney general and Zoe Baird as White House counsel.
Final vetting is now being done on two women lawyers with expectations that if all goes well, Bourne will be named attorney general and Baird will be named to head the White House legal staff. Bourne is a 52-year-old Washington corporate lawyer and founder of the Women's Law Center. She was the first woman head of the American Bar Association's Judicial Screening Committee, which rates candidates for federal judgeships, and she's widely respected as a cool and tough negotiator. She has, however, no law enforcement experience. Baird, at age 40, is senior vice president and general counsel of the Aetna Life and Casualty Company. President-elect Clinton has had a particularly difficult time filling the attorney general's position. Two judges, federal judge Patricia Wald and New York judge Judith Kaye, rejected his overtures for the job, although Wald visited Little Rock once and Kaye twice to discuss the position. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
NASA has announced the first scheduled space shuttle launch for the new year. The six-day mission is expected to take off from Cape Canaveral in Florida on January 13th. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed higher today, gaining nearly 9 points to close at 3321.10. This is NPR News in Washington. A bomb exploded in a London subway station today during the evening rush hour. However, no one was injured in the blast because of a telephone warning received less than an hour before the explosion. The anonymous caller used a code word that indicated the explosion was the responsibility of the Irish Republican Army. Police in London have been warning of an IRA Christmas bombing campaign. On December 16th, two bombs went off in the Oxford Street shopping area in London, slightly injuring four people. The IRA also claimed responsibility for those attacks. The United Nations announced today that a senior diplomat will meet with Israeli government leaders to discuss last week's forced expulsion of more than 400 Palestinians. The announcement came 4 days after the UN Security Council voted to condemn the expulsions. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The UN said that Undersecretary General James Jonah will travel to the Middle East to meet with Israeli government leaders. Officials would not say when he will leave or whom he will meet with. The trip is being made at the behest of the Security Council, which passed a resolution late Friday night asking Israel to rescind the expulsions. Israel claims it expelled the Palestinians last week because they have links to Islamic fundamentalist groups responsible for the deaths of six Israeli troopers. The Palestinians are being housed in tents outside the Israeli security zone in southern Lebanon because the Lebanese government refuses to admit them. The Israeli Supreme Court today upheld the expulsions, saying that because the Palestinians are now on Lebanese soil, the government is no longer responsible for them. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
More than 100,000 people marched through the streets of Frankfurt, Germany Tuesday night in the latest demonstration against neo-Nazi violence there. Officials say church bells were rung as the protesters formed a line 4 miles long around the city's center. The demonstration was held to show anger at attacks on foreigners by right-wing extremists. The demonstration broke up peacefully after about a half an hour. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Reporters covering the war in the former Yugoslavia are at great risk. Misha Glennie says this has been a particularly dangerous war for journalists. Glennie has been covering it from the start. He's the BBC's Central Europe correspondent. His reports are often heard on National Public Radio. Glennie is also the author of the new book, The Fall of Yugoslavia. He's back with us to discuss his experiences covering the war. I spoke with him earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London. Glennie is in London for a few weeks. I asked him where he's headed next.
At the beginning of February, I am moving to Thessalonica in northern Greece, which is just south of Yugoslavia, and I will continue traveling around Yugoslavia, but I'm also very concerned about the possibility of a Balkan war centered on the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and Thessalonica is frankly the best place to oversee a Balkan war like that. I don't know, to be perfectly honest, how long I can carry on doing this, because I knew Yugoslavia for a long time before it started breaking up. I know the country very well indeed, and I never really imagined that they could fall into such patterns of appalling violence and viciousness and just the most terrible, terrible things. And I've got to a stage where I can't hear another Croat tell me that the Serbs are the most primitive, vicious people in the world, and I can't hear another Serb say that the Muslims want to force a jihad on the whole of Europe and why aren't we helping Serbs. I've heard too much of the nonsense from all sides, and I'm beginning to run out of ideas as to how we can solve this situation.
You've taken a break from covering the war. How did you decide that it was time to take that break?
Well, largely because my contract with the BBC came up for renewal.
Oh, I see.
But it was more than that. There came a point where I was too exhausted, where I was too depressed by everything I was seeing, but also I've come under a lot of criticism, particularly from Serbs and Croats, but also from Muslims about my coverage of the war. I get a lot of hate letters, a lot of death threats.
For what?
Because they say that I'm a traitor to the Serbian nation or a traitor to the Croat nation, I'm a sympathiser with Muslim fundamentalists or whatever. The problem is, in the Yugoslav crisis, is that unless you take a definite side, then everybody considers you a traitor. If you try and understand this conflict and try and report this conflict as a complex problem, then you will be attacked by all sides. all the populations in Yugoslavia have been traumatized beyond any sort of rational behavior at all. They are all becoming or have already become completely insane, not because they are bad people or anything like that, but they have simply suffered too many privations and experienced too much violence to be able to think properly. And so as a consequence, those of us who do attempt an objective reportage of what's going on, we are considered part of the problem.
I was reading that more journalists have been killed in the former Yugoslavia than in the wars in Vietnam and in Lebanon combined. Why is that?
It's because this war is a war taking place with enormous amounts of weaponry. This weaponry has been stockpiled for 40 years by Tito's army. In addition to that, there is no sanctity to the profession of journalist in this war. Indeed, often if you drive around in the frontline areas with the word journalist or press on your car, then you're a target. Most of the journalists have been killed by Serbs, but there have been several killed by Croats and by Muslims as well. I was during the course of the war, my car was shot at twice. At one point it was machine gunned and fortunately missed my petrol tank as I sped away at high speed. I was also hit by a sniper when I was on Sarajevo airport in UN-protected territory, and that sniper didn't come from a Serb area, that came from a Muslim area at that time. All of us have had to suffer, all of the journalists on the front line have had to suffer endless mortar attacks and grenade attacks.
What do you do to protect yourself?
The only thing we do to protect ourselves is we have bulletproof jackets and we have helmets now, which is standard issue. In fact, you can't get into Sarajevo. The UN won't let you in unless you have those two items. And in addition to that, you have to take care. I mean, that means on many occasions when you're faced with these most appalling people, I can't tell you what it's like driving up to these barricades where you're faced with five or six guerrillas who would, you know, make the Medellin cartel foot soldiers look like a bunch of saints. They've got grenades patterned all over them. They have a Kalashnikov in each hand. And they're absolutely terrifying. And you have to talk your way through these barricades. And you know that if you say one wrong word, then your throat will be slit just like that. So you have to be very careful negotiating your path around where you're going. You have to be very careful about what you're doing on the front line. You just have to keep your head down as much as possible.
What are the safest things to say at a checkpoint?
It's very difficult to tell. I mean, one of the problems is, particularly at the beginning of the war, it's more easy to recognise them now, and we know where the front lines are drawn. But at the beginning of the Bosnian War, because they were all still wearing the same uniforms, you never knew whether you'd come up to a Serb, a Croat, or a Muslim barricade. And so, I mean, there was a time when I was running around Bosnia and I had this letter signed from Radovan Karadzic, the head of the Bosnian Serbs, saying that I was a friend of Serbia and that I could go through all the Serbian barricades. And I had a letter from the leader of the Croats saying exactly the same vis the Croats, and a letter from Izetbegovic saying the same thing as the Muslims. But each time I got to a barricade, I had to be very careful as to which letter I pulled out, because if I'd have pulled out the wrong letter, that would have been it. I'd have been dead on the spot.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Misha Glenny. He's a correspondent for the BBC who's based in Central Europe. He's been covering the war in the former Yugoslavia. He's also the author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is BBC correspondent Misha Glenny, who's been covering the war in the former Yugoslavia, and he's also the author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia. This is a war in which we've heard a lot of reports about terrible atrocities, mass murders, mass rapes, rape camps. How have you been trying to confirm what's actually happening, which atrocities are rumors, which atrocities are actually taking place?
Well, when the war started, I knew that the atrocities were going to happen because I was only too well apprised with Yugoslav history, basically, and I knew that this was going to happen. Establishing them was much more difficult. I did a lot of work on several massacres which took place during the Croatian work of Serbs by Croats and of Croats by Serbs. It was very difficult to do. It meant talking to a lot of people. It meant talking to eyewitnesses. It meant inspecting bodies which were horribly mutilated. But succeed in doing so, I did, and so did many others. When it comes to Bosnia, the atrocities are much worse. It's been very difficult to verify what's going on, but there are occasions when, for example, some soldiers who are trigger-happy actually pose in front of the cameras while they're doing their killings and while they're performing their mutilations. We've got some proof from there. But it's very, very difficult, and as regards the rape stories, really all we have to go on is the testimony of the poor women themselves.
When a woman tells you that she was raped, is your first inclination to believe it or to insist on some kind of confirmation?
Well, it's very difficult because they're no longer in the places where it happened, and they have no ways of proving to you that it happened. But I remember the first time that I interviewed a refugee of ethnic cleansing. I was in Sarajevo, and I talked to a Muslim woman from Visegrad, and she had clearly been through so much that when she discussed her story with me, she sat down and she told the whole thing without emotion at all. She wasn't raped, but she told a story of how a Serbian soldier forced her neighbour to shoot her son by putting a gun in his mouth. I mean, it was really simply the most atrocious story. And I knew when she was telling this story that she was not lying because she had lost all sense of emotion. She had been completely stripped of any ability to react in a human way because of the atrocities that she had experienced. And she was very careful talking about who did what and who didn't participate and who did participate, whether they were from the outside or whether they were local people. And after a while, you begin to be able to tell. I mean, it's true that many, many people lie in Yugoslavia. It's a generic problem in the region. But after a while, you begin to tell those who are telling the truth and those who are fabricating. But a lot of the time, it's just down to guesswork.
You write that despite the dangers to which you've been exposed, you've never succeeded in discarding your unswerving cowardice. In what way do you feel like you've been a coward during the war?
Well, because I became a journalist because I was a specialist on Eastern Europe and East European politics, and I speak a number of the local languages, and I know a lot about the history and politics. But as a journalist, you get sucked into the day-to-day thing. But I have absolutely no intention whatsoever of ever becoming a war correspondent, nor do I like being a war correspondent. I have to say, it's absolutely terrifying. There's no delight in it whatsoever. I don't understand those journalists who clearly get a macho kick out of doing this sort of thing and risking your life the whole time and watching people suffer day after day. And every time I go towards the front line, you know, I don't have the sense of the excitement which other journalists do. I think, oh my God, here we go again. I've got to face these dreadful people, these bastards. I mean, I've got to face these ghastly monsters. And, you know, I don't want to. I'm a coward. I admit it freely.
Have you thought of asking for a different assignment or staying home and writing books? Because you're going back to where you think the war's going to spread to.
Yeah, that's, well, you know, I mean, I know these people very well, and I've known Yugoslavia for a very long time, and I think it's the most appalling tragedy. And the problem is that a lot of people covering this war have absolutely no idea of what's going on in Yugoslavia. They're there for the bang-bangs, basically, and for the pictures for TV and so on and so forth, and a lot of nonsense is talked about this war. In addition to that, I have many, many friends in all of the former republics of Yugoslavia. And for both those reasons, you feel a responsibility to those people who want information about Yugoslavia and to those very dear friends that you have in Yugoslavia. You cannot leave them in the lurch, and it's your responsibility to stay there and make sure their tragedy gets reported properly. And although, I mean, I am tiring of it a great deal and I can't bear the idea of spending the rest of my life in the Balkans, I can't bring myself to leave it yet.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you good luck when you return to cover the spreading war. You're off to Greece next.
That's right, yes. Well, thanks very much. I'm going to need all the luck I can get, I'm sure.
Misha Glenny is the BBC's correspondent in Central Europe, and he's the author of The Fall of Yugoslavia, published by Penguin Books. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, Governor Bill Clinton had some more selections for his cabinet. What do you have on that?
We'll be talking with Mara Liasson soon about the choices of Warren Christopher for State, Les Aspin for Defense, Madeleine Albright to be UN Ambassador, and James Woolsey to be CIA Director. Also, the choice of Anthony Lake as National Security Advisor. All those and a couple of other appointments named today, made today in Little Rock. Also, a talk today with Deborah Amos in Mogadishu about the call on the part of Boutros-Ghali, the UN Secretary General to the United States-led forces there to disarm the various factions in Somalia. That, Deborah tells us, is not what they see their role as being, and it's not what they're doing.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the jazz reissue business has been kind to Billie Holiday fans. Her recordings have been meticulously reissued by Columbia, Decca, and Verve. Holiday's work for the Verve label was her last great body of work, and the most controversial because of the world weariness in her voice. Here's Holiday in 1952 with Flip Phillips on tenor saxophone.
East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love, dear, near to the sun in the day, near to the moon at night. We'll live in a lovely way, dear, living on love and pale moonlight.
If you're flush with money this holiday season and gift hunting for that jazz fan who pulled you out from under an oncoming train, here's what to get them for Christmas. Not just one of those big lavish box sets, but the classiest reissue of the year. The complete Billie Holiday on Verve, 1945 to 1959.
Lady sings the blues. She's got them there. She feels so sad. Wants the world to know just what her blues is all about.
I'm not into reissues as fetishistic objects. The appeal should be the music, not the box it comes in. But this Billie Holiday set is pretty nice. It's deluxe, but small and space-efficient. Real record collectors are always short of space and don't appreciate boxes that are four times too big. The heart of the set is a sort of miniaturized replica of those bulky albums 78s came in, back when some of this music was recorded. The 10 CDs slip into little cardboard sleeves bound together like a book. It's adorably cute, even if you can't pull the disc out without leaving fingerprints. There's also a 200-page bound booklet with essays, charts, photos, interviews, transcripts of conversations, and an extended bibliography. That's if you have time to read even more about Holiday after listening to all the studio recordings and concerts, living room rehearsals, and sessions when the engineers left the tape running. From those, you get a sense of the drudgery of recording, at odds with the spontaneity musicians try to maintain.
I'm feeling so bad. I wish you'd make the music.
No, baby, clear your throat. Clear your throat, Billy. It's all clear? 205-64, one for my baby, take three.
It's quarter to three. There's no one in the place except you and me.
The quest to include every surviving scrap of Billie Holiday gets out of hand. You hear her tell musicians an ethnic joke, which shouldn't have been included, not because it's offensive, which it really isn't, but because it's something she clearly never intended for public consumption. This is an invasion of privacy on a record company's part. Granted, there are some very obsessive Billie Holiday fans, and these later recordings inspire cult-like devotion. Holiday in her last decade was plagued by drug problems, legal hassles, and bad men, and those troubles left their mark on her singing. Her small vocal range shrank even more, and her once girlish voice cracked and tired out. Personally, I think the carefree, lilting, younger Holiday was jazz's greatest singer, but you compare. First, we'll hear Holiday in 1935 at age 20, and then 20 years later.
Begged of a star to throw me a beam or two, wished on a star and asked for a dream or two. I look for every loveliness and all came true.
The Billie Holiday you prefer may depend on whether you see art as fundamentally tragic or comic, whether you prefer Ingmar Bergman or Preston Sturgis. For me, the lightness and hope in her early art are more profound and restorative, but the later stuff does have undeniable power. Now, critics are always quick to recommend you buy expensive box sets we get free, and selling for around $160, this one ain't cheap. But if you want that prestige item to make friends drool 5 years from now, think of it as an investment in one-upmanship. Oh, and Merry Christmas.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed the complete Billie Holiday on Verve, 1945 to 1959. I'm Terry Gross.
This torch that I found must be drowned, or it soon might explode. Make one for my baby and one more for the road. That long, long road.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
How do all the companies that send you catalogs and junk mail know to target you? How do they know your income, your marital status, your children's age? On the next Fresh Air, we find out from journalist Eric Larson. He says direct marketing is so sophisticated it rivals some intelligence operations. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.